Hi everyone, welcome to episode 4 of API Busters. I'm Grace, and here with me is also Phil. Phil, say hi.
Hello.
And today we have the awesome Daryl Miller with us today.
Hello, folks.
And he's going to talk to us about OpenAPI. So I'm going to kick us off and just going to ask Daryl to talk a little bit about himself. Who are you and how did you get involved with the OpenAPI Institute?
I am a software developer, love a very many long years. I currently work at Microsoft, working on the Azure API management team. For the last probably 10 years, I've been fairly steeped in doing all things API related. Earlier on, a lot of my time was focused around doing hypermedia type stuff, so I really didn't have any time for that swagger static descriptions of APIs. But about 2 years ago, I started to pay a little bit more attention to where swagger was going and the amount of attention that was being paid to it, and started commenting on what I liked and what I didn't like about it. And when the OpenAPI initiative was founded, one of the founding members, one of the representatives, asked if I would be interested in getting involved. And it was one of those things, well, if you can't beat them, join them, and maybe I can make things better from the inside rather than just sitting and complaining on Twitter. So I joined at that point, and when pretty much the last 18 months, 2 years, we've been working on making version 3 of OpenAPI a reality.
I don't know about that stab about complaining on Twitter. I mean, that's basically my hobby.
It's a very rewarding hobby.
I think it's more than your hobby. I think it's your part-time job to your full-time job. But
it's better than programming.
It relieves some of that pent-up frustration you get when dealing with computers every day.
Damn pesky computers.
This is very true.
Anywho.
Just to get out of the way, what's the difference between Swagger and OpenAPI? Because everyone talks about both at work all the time, and I'm trying to get them to just talk about OpenAPI.
Yes, it's a rather unfortunate thing that we have to change the names, but for legal reasons, we do have to change. When the company SmartBear acquired all of the intellectual property of Swagger, the specification and the related open source projects, and the person who originally created the project, Tony Tam, and one of the longtime contributors, Ron Rutofsky, went and joined SmartBear. And they went and worked for SmartBear, and the SmartBear kind of decided, look, we really want the specification to be usable by everybody and get really even more adoption than it already had. So in order to do that, it kind of needed to be vendor neutral. So they took the specification and donated that to the Linux Foundation. And Linux Foundation started this project called the OpenAPI Initiative. So the specification part of things now is owned and run by the Linux Foundation, and in that process, it was decided it would be better to have a name change. So the specification is now called OpenAPI. The name Swagger is maintained for the tooling that SmartBear work on. So that's Swagger UI, Swagger Editor, Swagger CodeGen. And they are continuing to develop those open source and invest in those open source products. So when you talk about Swagger, you're talking about tooling that works with the OpenAPI spec. But then there's lots of other tooling out there that also works with the OpenAPI spec. It's not exactly the most catchy name, and we are working on trying to find a way of making it more exciting. I don't know if anybody was listening to the whole conversation around the recent API Strat conference. There is a proposal floating that we adopt the mascot of the Okapi animal, which is spelled OK. OKAPI. And the Okapi, it looks, it's kind of like a cross between a zebra and a giraffe.
Oh.
And that kind of strange blend fits very nicely with the idea of some kind of technical specification that's designed by committee.
I guess a giraffe will make for some interesting mascots, and we can follow the whole PHP crew and do the plush toys and do Kickstarters, maybe.
That's how fantastic. Something becomes popular in the tech world, guys. A cute animal mascot. That's what everyone needs, for anyone that's trying to develop tooling that should be popular. But yeah, you mentioned the OpenAPI initiative/institute that was, you know, set up by the Linux Foundation. To sort of be, you know, like the parent or like the home for the you know, Swagger to open API sort of like transition. Can you tell us a little bit about what the goals of the Open API Institute are beyond like maintaining this stuff?
Yeah, no, I have to fix this because I have this really bad habit of saying institute and it's not. It's Open API Initiative. So I really, like, it's not it. And I keep doing that, so bad on me. But yes, Open API Initiative. Yes, so we are now a group of 30 member companies, and a lot of the big companies, Microsoft and Google, and Red Hat, and lots of other companies are members of this organization. And our goal is to shepherd the spec in the coming years, to continue to meet the needs of the API community when it comes to being able to describe APIs. And we are purely spec. We don't endorse any tooling. We don't write any tooling, deliver any tooling. That's the job of the open API community to actually write. Because we don't, I think, picking favorites of tools or picking kind of recommended tooling just kind of kills other efforts in the industry. So our goal is purely to produce the specification and encourage other vendors and other community people to actually build tools around that spec.
I think that's a pretty good way to go. Most standards bodies seem to do the same thing. Like I helped out with the PHP FIG, the Framework Interoperability Group in the PHP world for a while, and they were kind of the same thing. They're like, here's a markdown file, and maybe here's like an interface for a library, but you have to build all the stuff yourself, because otherwise there's not much chance for innovators. Everyone will just use the provided implementation, regardless of whether it's very good or not. So
yeah,
that makes a lot of sense. It's kind of a funny thing where you were saying about how Swagger is like the name for the official tooling made by SmartBear. There's also a lot of other tools that just have that Swagger name, right? Because the very fact that it works, a piece of code works with a certain standard, you're going to want to put that standard in the name. So I have a really confusing time when I started getting into OpenAPI a couple of months ago of trying to find tools. Because I'd be trying to find, I'm always told, like, you've got to call it OpenAPI. We're calling it OpenAPI now. Don't call it Swagger. So you'd be there Googling for like OpenAPI to Postman conversion, converter, and you can't find one. And then you're like, oh, wait, it's because I have to type Swagger to Postman. And then you find it through that. So you're kind of like crossing this awkward bridge between the two things.
Yeah, but yeah, it's unfortunate, but and we will go through a transition for quite a while. But, you know, you got to look at it as both a positive and negative thing. The fact that you're looking for existing tools and you can find existing tools is just a reflection on the success of the ecosystem. So, unfortunately, for the moment, there's going to be tooling that has the name Swagger on it that really shouldn't. And that's, unfortunately, the job of SmartBear to go and fix that problem. We have our own problems with the OAI to deal with, convincing everybody to use the much more buttoned-up term OpenAPI that feels very enterprise-y to people.
Very fancy, yeah, very white shirt. I think that most of those tools are just going to kind of fall away over time, mostly because pretty much every time I find a tool that says Swagger in the title, it's unmaintained. Like, the vast majority of them that I've come across have just been like some old node library that hasn't been touched in a year or two. So I think as we start to see people kind of migrate towards version 3 support, most of those tools are just going to kind of flop into irrelevancy. But What are the main differences between version 3? Like, why should people be really excited about this new version that came out like 2-3 months ago?
It came out in July is when we finally got the stuff together.
I think it came out the day after my birthday. I was really excited that you got me such a nice birthday gift.
You know what? I was trying to get it on my birthday and we missed. So I missed by just a few days. the main features that people usually reference when talking about what's new in OpenAPI v3 is the ability to describe callbacks is one, and the ability to describe links is the other. So callbacks is kind of obvious insofar as you can describe an operation that allows you to register for at some later point somebody to call you back. And maybe that is just a single async operation, or maybe it is like a webhook where you're subscribing so that you're going to get multiple callbacks. So you describe the subscription endpoint in the same way as any other normal API operation. But then attached to that response description, you can say, oh, but you will also get these requests that are coming back to you. And the requests are going to look like this. It's going to have these headers in it, and it's going to have this body. And then it can even say, oh, and we expect these status codes to that you should return to us. So the one example that maybe why you'd want to specify a status code is some people will use the 410 gone status code as an indication where the client says, yeah, I don't want to hear any more of those notifications. So you can actually describe in your API that if a client who's receiving a callback says, oh, yeah, okay, that's great, I got that callback, but I don't want to get any more, it can, instead of just returning a 200 back, it can return a 410. And that will automatically unsubscribe. So you can do all kinds of clever stuff like that with the callbacks description.
Oh, that's awesome. I actually hadn't seen that. I've been looking a lot in OpenAPI v2 and v3 stuff. And I guess most of it's been kind of the slightly improved static functionality, like, request body, and instead of kind of mashing things into form data parameters. But like servers being an array now, that's cool. But I had no idea about callbacks, actually. That's fantastic.
Yeah, so callbacks is one. The other one is links. So this is, although we called it links and we did debate long and hard as to whether to call this links, this isn't an attempt to do hypermedia. This is specifically a way of saying that when you go and make this call to this operation, you're going to get a response back. And with the information that you get back in this response, you could then call this related operation. And the best way that I've found to sort of describe this is one of the things that it would enable is building clients that have kind of like a fluent interface. So you call this operation, and then from that operation, you can then call this other operation. And basically, we have a kind of runtime syntax that allows you to extract values out of the response body and feed them into parameters of the related operation. So generating fluent interfaces on clients is one thing that we're hoping people will be able to do with this capability. The other thing is in generating documentation. Because at the moment, currently in documentation, you basically just get this kind of a flat list of these are all the operations. And, or maybe it's like one tier where it's like, this is the path and these are the methods underneath the particular path or resource. With the introduction of links, the documentation can now kind of lead a reader through a path. So they can go and look at a particular operation and say, okay, this is a response that I'm going to come back. Well, now what can I do with it? And we can actually, in the documentation, say, oh, well, from this response, you can go to this other operation and have a link in the documentation. So we can now actually describe scenarios of traversing through the API. Now, all of this said, these are static links. These aren't suggesting you have to put links in the response body, and we don't have the benefits of hypermedia, where in hypermedia, the presence of a link in a body tells you a certain piece of information. This is just saying you might be able to call this other operation from this particular first operation that you called. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I think that's a very interesting and sort of like fine distinction between, you know, the links in the open API world and hypermedia. And it's very interesting. I'm definitely going to look more into that. It sounds like useful and descriptive in the ways that our APIs and perhaps many other APIs could really benefit from.
Well, one of the objections to hypermedia is often they say, well, I don't want to put all these links in my payload and make my payload heavier, which, fair enough. That's not a problem. If you don't want to do that, don't do that. This gives you another alternative of describing those relationships.
Yeah, I think in the last episode, we were talking about hypermedia. I think you mentioned that you listened to that one. We were talking about kind of some of the different ways of doing hypermedia, right? The kind of more old-fashioned hit this URL with an options endpoint, and then there'll be some stuff in there that will describe some things. And that one was always kind of vague and hidden and magical and weird, so a lot of people didn't bother doing it. And now a lot of people are starting to use kind of Siren and other systems that put all of the metadata for how you construct those hyperlinks in the body. And that is kind of cool, and I've been looking at doing that. But as you said, a lot of people don't like adding bloat to their responses just for the sake of enabling next actions. So currently there's Hyperschema, which we'll get to in a little bit, JSON Hyperschema, which is kind of putting that same metadata just somewhere else and allowing a smart client to kind of construct them itself. And so with those three ways of already doing things, I definitely noticed a fair few people being like, oh my God, I can't believe OpenAPI did this thing. This doesn't do everything that I need it to, and that's bad. And I actually kind of appreciate that it is there and it is very basic and it's not meant to be a replacement because, yeah, like as you said, the documentation, the old Swagger UI, I haven't made too many bones about like making it clear I'm not really a fan. Like it's very RPC based, and so a lot of documentation, like even Redoc, which I'm a big fan of, and the only one that kind of avoids this is Spectable. Everything, all the documentation is basically, here's a list of endpoints that you should hit, and here are the method arguments you should throw at it, which is the very like crux of being RPC, right? There's no concept of, here's how you go from this to this, and here's the things that are available as the next actions, and it's just fire this thing at this thing. And so people can get into the habit of doing that with Swagger, but this is kind of a step towards still letting people use it in an RPC way, but also enabling the idea of, here's a next thing you can do, you know?
Yeah, but I mean, even if you take OpenAPI as a description, even if you're building the most hypermedia-enabled API, you're still probably going to create a set of documentation that identifies the resources that are available in your system. I mean,
yeah.
The core of a hypermedia API is describing the media types and describing the link relations. But describing the resources that exist in your system, the only thing that you really don't want to do as a consumer of the API is hard code those URLs into your client library. But you still want to know what things are available in that API. And you can do that with OpenAPI. Now, yes, okay, the way that current documentation renders it kind of puts that URL front and center, which is not necessarily ideal for consumers. It kind of encourages the wrong behavior. But there's no reason why somebody couldn't build another tool that displayed that documentation and kind of de-emphasized the URL as kind of a first-class thing. And the second thing is with OpenAPI v3, we've made the use of content types or media types much more first class within the actual description. So you now have a request body, which has a content object, which is a dictionary of these are all of the media types that you can send. And then in the response body, we have another content object with the set of media types. There's absolutely no reason that those media types couldn't be hypermedia. They could be Siren, Collection plus JSON, HAL, JSON-LD, Hyperschema, any one of those media types you could be using. And all you're doing is providing documentation saying, these are the set of media types that we support at this endpoint. The only thing that a hypermedia client should avoid is hard coding that information into the client library. well, I mean, it's got to hard code which media types. It's got to hard code what link relations into the client library. Otherwise, it's not going to know what to do with it. So we're not all the way there on being able to support hypermedia applications, and we're not focusing on trying to support them because most hypermedia folks don't want to use a static language. But the one thing that I do sort of say to people is, if you're building a hypermedia API, there's going to be a lot of people out there who might want a consumer API who've never consumed a hypermedia API. They don't quite know how to do it. And maybe giving them an open API description of your hypermedia API might kind of provide that bridge to help them understand better how to use your hypermedia API. It's just a thought.
It's a good thought, too. That was something that we covered quite extensively in the last episode, sort of like, you know, clients that have to support different types of APIs, you know, thinking through like, okay, this one's hypermedia, you know, how do I do it? Is it going to be more complicated? But to Phil's point, you know, definitely, you know, how can you encourage best practice? And, you know, how can we structure this documentation to do that? And how can we sort of like ingrain that into, you know, how clients are supposed to like consume the information about it and also the API? All very interesting thoughts. But one thing that I wanted to touch upon that you were talking about before, about how you guys weren't really focusing on hypermedia functionality inside OpenAPI, you know, what sort of new functionality can people expect, you know, soon or in the next 6 months or in the next, you know, year even for the OpenAPI specification?
Well, I can't guarantee anything because there's a whole bunch of people who get to choose as to what does and doesn't go in. I can tell you some things that I know a number of people have asked for and a number of us on the steering committee really want to get in. One of those is being able to define groups of reusable parameters. Currently, when you're describing an operation, you can use the $ref to say, here, reuse this parameter. Yeah. But there's no way to say, reuse this set of parameters.
Ooh, I like that.
And,
ooh, I like that too.
Yeah, it's going to make as big of a difference as our current ability to put variables into servers. One thing that I see in a lot of the APIs, the management APIs for Azure at Microsoft, is every path has a subscription ID and a resource group name in it. And basically, every URL starts with /subscription/subscription ID/resource group/resource group name. And basically, now you've filled your console, and the part of the path that is interesting has scrolled off to the right. So by being able to create a base URL with parameters up in the server variables, then you can kind of extract that out of your API. So those kind of reuse capabilities, and I think parameter groups falls into that same case of people are kind of annoyed about having to re-specify over and over again. These four parameters have to go in every single operation.
Yeah, that was recently went to a hackathon, and I was building out this API that Thorn, the super awesome company, was building. And that was definitely something that we were kind of like, huh, is there a way to do this? And now there's going to be potentially a way. And that's very, very awesome.
Yeah.
And you kind of mentioned that, you know, hey, these aren't necessarily going to be exactly the things that are going to be introduced, and that there's, you know, some sort of like committee or some sort of like way that you guys sort of achieve consensus around what goes into it. Can you describe that process a little bit?
Yeah. So a lot of contributions come from the technical developer community at wide. Basically, anybody who's interested in OpenAPI can go open an issue, they can submit a pull request. And I mean, even things like the linking mechanism and the callback mechanism was something that was initiated by external people who weren't part of the core committee. But when it comes down to actually making a final say of, okay, yes, this is exactly the features that are going to go in and actually approving pull requests, there's a group currently, there's four of us, because we lost Tony Tam, who was the original creator of Swagger. He recently left. He retired from the OpenAPI business recently. So there's now just four of us, and we are currently in a nomination period to try and bring some to increase the number of people on the steering committee. Yes. So yes, to get some more. We've had a number of people who've been quite active in committing to the spec and providing suggestions and reviewing things. So there's a number of people that I expect will be joining in the short process. Actually, a lot of what we've been doing since we finished the spec in July is kind of a lot of housekeeping stuff. We were supposed to, you know, do a bunch of guidance and governance type documentation, and it all got kind of put off so that we could get the version 3 spec. So the last few months, our meetings have been around, okay, well, how do we nominate more people onto the spec, and what are the rules of how to do this, and what are the rules? All the stuff that us tech folk really hate is what we've been having to do for the last little while. So. Yeah. So
when I was poking around, continue.
I was just to say that this technical steering committee are really just the people who make the final say and make sure that the spec is heading in a consistent and coherent direction. That's definitely not the people who do necessarily all the work at all. It's just finally, it's just the people who have the final say, unfortunately.
Right. Yeah, I was poking around on the Open API initiative site earlier, and there's a Get Involved tab, but when you click on it, I'm not sure that it takes you anywhere. So that's something.
So one of the nice things about having a lot of member companies is we actually also have a marketing committee who get together, and we've actually used some of the sponsorship money for the member companies to bring in a marketing company to help us improve the process of actually helping people get on board. And they've come back with a ton of recommendations as to how to fix the website and how to help people say OpenAPI instead of Swagger, and to kind of build out an ambassador program and to recognize the people in the community who are talking about OpenAPI and promoting it and who are working with tools. So hopefully in the coming months, you'll see a little bit of more coordination and effort around those softer side of the OpenAPI initiative.
Very cool.
We kind of know we haven't been very good at that because we were desperately trying to finish the 3.0 spec. And so.
Yeah. No, it was no shade, not throwing any shade.
No, look, we all know the website could use some love.
Yeah, sorry about that grouchy video I did the other day. I was trying to be funny, but there's trying to find the specification if you don't know exactly where it lives is really hard to do. I think I might need to like send some pull requests to the website or something. But
you saw my comment on that insofar as I had never considered the fact that somebody would look at the markdown file and go, well, this isn't the official spec. Like, I'm so used to looking at that markdown file. It's like, oh, it's just a thing of beauty because it's done. So your comments caused a chain of effect, and Mike Ralphson went off and made that beautiful thing using BikeShed. We want to try and incorporate that so that everybody can benefit. So, I mean, all the feedback is just awesome. Whether it comes across as grumpy or not, doesn't matter.
Good. Problem solved.
It's all good.
Yeah, the kind of shoving it on, sending the link through to the markdown is one thing. But yeah, there's a few other kind of slightly more website, kind of more documentation-y looking views that Swagger have on their website, which is pretty helpful. But I'd be really happy to get that BikeShed print. For anyone that doesn't know, BikeShed is this cool tool that takes, I'm not sure how to describe it. It takes kind of RFC style documents and then kind of helps you present them as actual HTML in a more nice way, right? Is that about how you say?
Yeah. Well, I didn't know about the tool before Mike actually used it. So, but that definitely seems to be the best way of describing it.
Sweet. On to the next bit. So there's one thing that me and you have been talking about on and off for months, which is the... So JSON schema and OpenAPI are two very similar things, right? And so backstory for listeners who might not be quite as aware, OpenAPI or Swagger initially was based off of JSON schema syntax and used a lot of their keywords and used a lot of the same stuff. And I think the idea of Swagger was kind of you take a JSON schema file, you add in some more stuff, and then you kind of mention the query string parameters and everything else, right? Because JSON schema is only really good at describing the a chunk of JSON. So it can describe maybe the request and it can describe maybe a response, but that's basically it. So Swagger and now OpenAPI were designed to be a superset of JSON schema functionality, but that was back when JSON schema was fairly fresh and young and didn't do quite as many things. And JSON schema has evolved and OpenAPI has evolved, and you kind of ended up with two somewhat different things. And so Swagger v2 was actually quite different, like I'd say like 80% different to JSON schema. But then awesomely, version OpenAPI v3 kind of brought that difference quite close together. The differences now between JSON schema and OpenAPI are tiny, but there's still a couple of things left, including like how types work. Daryl, could you talk a little bit about that?
I can talk a little bit about it. I can't go too deep in it because my skills when it comes to JSON schema itself are fairly limited. But I mean, the particular issue you're referring to is this notion that in JSON schema, a type property can be an array. So it can be this type, or it can be that type, or it can be the other type. And we don't allow that in OpenAPI because fundamentally, we're trying to do something with JSON schema that it isn't specifically designed to do. JSON schema primarily was a way of validating that JSON meets a bunch of rules. And the rules could be, well, it needs to be this type or that type or the other type. Whereas what we're trying to use it for is sort of a type description or a type modeling language. So in most programming languages, a class can't be two different types. It is one type. I mean, you have inheritance and you have other more fancy stuff, but generally speaking, a type is a type. A type isn't one of many different types. So we have taken a subset of that JSON schema capabilities and narrowed it down so that it is easier for tooling to take that JSON schema and create a type out of it, either for on the client side or for on the server side. So that's the primary reason why we don't support that type. Now, having said that, that's the same reason why we in V2 we didn't support things like one of, and we got sufficient pushback where people said, no, I absolutely want to have one of and any of. So we actually did add it in. So we sort of allowed that kind of variant type capability in through the back door. There are other ways of doing it in programming languages. So we've kind of made the tooling harder. One of the original premises behind a lot of the decisions that were made in OpenAPI was we want to describe an API, but not any and every API. We want to describe it with enough capabilities to have a useful API, but something that's not tremendously difficult for people to write tools around. So we were always cautious about adding in features that would make it harder to write tooling against. One of our goals, and it'll be interesting to see whether we achieve this moving forward, is to be able to get to the point where we can, as an organization, say, this tool passes our requirements for being OpenAPI v3 compliant. So that you talked before about the fact that you go searching for tools and a lot of the tools that you find are kind of dead and neglected and don't work properly. We want to be able to get to a point where we can say, look, this set of tools, we're not saying that any of them are our favorites or that we don't have any preference. We're just saying they have been tested and they work against the specification. So when we make it harder for tools to actually produce things that are compliant to the spec, we're sort of shooting ourselves in the foot. So there's that balance there between, well, these customers want this extra feature, but it's going to make it harder for all the tooling people to actually implement that feature. So that's kind of been our guiding premise so far. Now, talking about schemas as a whole and talking about what we'd like to do in the future, one of the things is JSON's schema is really great at describing JSON. And some people still use XML. And I'm quite sure in a few years' time, there'll be new formats that we're going to be using. In fact, there are people who want to be able to send protobuffer.
I was just going to say
protobuf payloads, and they have their own schema. And there's all kinds of different formats, and the web is made up of many different formats. And tying us to one format is not ideal. It doesn't let us live forever. So, I mean, one of the efforts that we did in version 2 was we had this kind of extension to be able to try and describe XML. And if you've ever met a person that likes the way we do that, I'd like to meet them because okay. I haven't yet. I would love to be in a position where we can say, we support other schemas. You can use XSD or you can point to an XSD from that schema or you can point to a protobuf. Scheme. Obviously, we can't embed XML into JSON very easily. I mean, you can do it as a quoted string, but who wants to do that, right? So it would probably be via external pointers. So that's one of the goals moving forward is to try and support external schemas. Of course, we come back to the problem of as soon as we allow support of different schemas, what are the requirements that we put on people who are building tooling? I mean, do we designate these four schemas as the official ones and require every tooling vendor to support all four? Or do we have like blessed schemas that are then optional for tooling folks to support? The problem then is people will come along and use the tooling and say, this is an official OAI blessed tooling, but when I try and use it with my protobuf, it doesn't work. And we go, well, yeah, because that vendor didn't want to support protobuf. So again, there's difficult choices to make there. But we definitely want to support more than just JSON schema in the future.
Yeah, that sounds brutal. that's an ongoing problem. Like I've just started at work. We've just started kind of documenting our APIs, right? The last couple of months, we've got like 50 APIs and now like 10 of them are half documented or something. So yay for progress. And we're getting there. Like the teams, we're educating people and it's gone from literally just me shouting at people in the hallways about documenting to like now there's like 10 people that actively care. So we're making progress.
Passive-aggressive, like Slack messages.
How are the docs going? Grace, come on, write some docs. Hey, come on. So now that we've got that covered, I'm moving into AMQP message documentation, right? Because it's just as important. Like anywhere there's a contract that someone doesn't know, someone should know what that is. Instead of just firing random strings of shit around, like we should know what that is. So I've started working on a thing to help us document that. Very similar. I'm going to be using JSON schema because it's JSON. But we've acquired a couple of companies who love to use things that aren't just JSON. And all of a sudden, I'm met with this like, new technology. So they want to be able to send protobuf in AMQP messages. And that kind of screws up some of my let's support the old JSON ones. So I immediately have to start supporting both JSON schema and protobuf. And the rate that WeWork seem to be acquiring companies recently, we're gonna just get some other company that does some other thing I've never even heard of. So I can totally understand your concerns about supporting all these different formats because they are very different. It's like building an ORM that works with like 10 different database vendors, and all of those database vendors have completely different functionality. So you either just take the absolute lowest common denominator and piss off everyone, or you bend over backwards trying to support every feature for all of them in a way that works for everyone, which just means you never release your software. So that is a very difficult problem.
So you brought up another interesting point there. Is you're talking about sending protobuf packages, but you're talking about sending them over AMQP. So AMQP, it's not an HTTP protocol. And we, as the OpenAPI spec, is specialized for describing HTTP requests and responses. And if you go on our GitHub issues, you will find hundreds of requests of, I want to support WebSockets. I want to support server-side events. I want to support MQTT, all of these kind of things. And
that's too many things. That's complicated.
Well, this is the thing. It messaging is generically, it's quite different than the way request responses work in HTTP. And so far, I've just pushed back on a lot of these requests and said, look, we're just not going to add this because it's just fundamentally different. If you can map it to an HTTP request response, fine, map it. But if you can't, then it's just not ideal. And we're not going to add into the OpenAPI spec something that is fundamentally different than HTTP. Having said that, some guys from Hitch over in Barcelona created this thing called Async API. And they took the V3 of the OpenAPI spec and they copied the bits that are the same. And then they threw away the bits that were related to HTTP and added in new stuff. They added in events and topics and messages. And this is something that we're talking very seriously within the OAI about, well, maybe that's what we need in the OAI is we need a sister spec that is designed specifically for messaging that can share some of the capabilities, like the reusable models and definitions and schemas and stuff and parameter descriptions and stuff like that, but then has these unique things that are specific to the messaging world. And maybe moving forward, as we leverage other different metadata descriptions, maybe they can apply across both the OpenAPI for describing HTTP and the Async API for describing messaging type APIs. And I think that's a better approach longer term than trying to jam everything into the OpenAPI description, which was primarily designed for HTTP. So that's where I'd like to see things go.
Very, very cool.
And maybe even one day, an RPC description format.
Mind officially blown.
Stop making more people try to do more RPC. It's not like we need help with them doing that.
That'll be when Phil just like officially logs off the internet. Hey, RPC is just the natural way to go, apparently. I'm kidding. No one, don't harass me on the internet over that. Okay. Anyways, I think that's all the time that we've got, pretty much. Is there anything else that you want to talk about, Daryl? Anything that you want to finish off on?
That's a very good question.
You haven't plugged the Azure API at any point.
Oh, yeah.
The Azure API? You mean API management? The product that I work on diligently from day in and day out?
Ooh, tell me more.
It's an HTTP intermediary, and I love HTTP intermediaries. It sits between the client and server and adds all kinds of extra value to HTTP requests. So if you are thinking of building an API as a product, go look for an API management type product because they will save you a ton of time and let you focus on actually building your product and not doing stupid things like rate limiting and caching and all of those kind of key management and all that stuff, because it's hard stuff that nobody wants to have to do. So that's what API management products do for you.
Yeah, don't reinvent the wheel for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that was really wonderful. We were so happy to have you here.
I'm very happy to be here. It's always fun to talk to people about APIs and stuff. And the other thing is people should keep their eyes open if they're interested in APIs for all the API conferences that are going on. API Days happens all over the world. It's in Paris. It's in Barcelona. I believe it's coming to Colorado next year. There's we will be planning another episode of API Strategy Conference in 2018. And I believe Tessa Marrow is doing API City Conf in Seattle in the spring.
Yeah, that's the one.
Definitely, if you want to learn more about APIs, get out to one of the API conferences because it's a fabulous community of people and super friendly, and you'll learn a ton.
We'll make sure to shove a bunch of links in the footnotes, especially the conference being done by Tessa Miro. She's organized a bunch of PHP conferences in the past, and they've always been fantastic. So if you're thinking of going to an API conference and you're near-ish Seattle or fancy going there to get rained on for a while, that would definitely be a good one to go to.
And there we go, the end of another fantastic episode. If you enjoyed listening to this, go to apibusters.com. There are three previous episodes you can listen to about different stuff. And you can also subscribe to our newsletter so that you get alerts about new episodes. Thanks very much, and I hope you enjoyed listening.